It is a simple sentence with complex ramifications for Milwaukee, for people in positions of power, for how victims are treated in the justice system. The sentence is, Jane Doe is still waiting for justice. We will dig into the case of Jane Doe on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is a sensitive topic, so please take care. In the summer of 2019, a woman came forward to the Milwaukee Police Department and said she had been raped by a prominent Milwaukee real estate developer 5 years earlier. The woman is identified publicly only as Jane Doe, and her case exposed deeper problems in power structures of government and law enforcement. The accused is Kalen Haywood Sr., who has denied the allegations, who has not been arrested nor charged with any crime. Have you followed this case? How do you feel about the way police investigate sexual assault cases? 800-642-1234 to join in. Gina Barton is an investigative reporter for USA Today, previously worked for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, and co-authored a four-part series examining how Milwaukee authorities responded to a reported sexual assault. Gina, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, let's start with who this case revolves around, and that is Kalen Haywood Sr., the woman reported being drugged and raped. And for people not familiar with this person, who is Haywood in the Milwaukee community?
He is a prominent Black developer, and he's gotten millions and millions of dollars in city-backed loans for redevelopment projects on the north side of the city. So the one that he is working on currently is he's trying to convert a former Sears store into a hotel.
And so he has many ties, many connections in the community, and is also receiving city loans for projects.
That's right. And one of the controversial things that we found in our reporting is even after Jane Doe reported him to the police and accused him of rape, after that, he was approved for another several million dollars in loans for this project. And all of that is funded by the taxpayers.
In 2019, a Milwaukee police detective questioned Haywood about the reported sexual assault, and the questioning occurred at the Sojourner Family Peace Center. Why did the location of this interview attract attention?
The Sojourner Family Peace Center is a complex that is designed specifically to serve and assist victims of domestic violence and sexual assault. And it has kind of three different sections. One of them is the domestic violence shelter, and one of them houses offices. And some of those offices are for members of the police department who investigate these types of crimes. And back before this new complex even opened in 2016, the executive director of Sojourner and the person who has been the police chief, Ed Flynn, signed an agreement that suspects would never be interviewed there, because since the location isn't secret, as a lot of domestic violence shelters are, in order for victims to feel secure, they need to know that perpetrators aren't going to be coming in and out of there. And so even though they had this agreement in place that suspects shouldn't be questioned there, Kalen Haywood Sr. was in fact questioned there by a detective.
How did Milwaukee police explain this decision?
Basically, everybody from the new chief, Alfonso Morales, on down, the captain, the assistant chiefs, all said they didn't know that suspects weren't supposed to be questioned there. But during the interview itself, the detective said to Kalen Haywood Sr., hey, you know, suspects aren't supposed to be questioned in this building. If Carmen Petrie, the executive director, knew that you were here, she would go to my captain and complain. So it's possible that he was lying. Police are allowed to lie to suspects, but it's also possible that he did know suspects weren't supposed to be questioned there.
The authorities have not charged, not arrested Haywood with any crime. How has he responded to Jane Doe's sexual assault allegations, the complaint itself?
Kalen Haywood Sr. did a long interview with my colleague Ashley Luthern and I, and we also have a video recording of that day that he was questioned by the detective, and throughout the entire thing, he has denied everything. He said he has never sexually assaulted anyone, and he would never, and that these are false allegations.
If you're just joining us, we're discussing how Milwaukee authorities responded to a reported sexual assault involving a well-connected business investor in the city. Gina Barton is an investigative reporter for USA Today, and she was the co-author with her fellow journalist, Ashley Luthern, on this series. You can join in. How well do you think police handle sexual assault cases? What problems do you see? What are you concerned about here? 800-642-1234. Gina, you've covered criminal justice in Milwaukee for nearly two decades. And I'm wondering, you know, did your longtime beat help you see really complex connections in this story and put things together here? Because this is a very complicated story.
Yes, I think the long time that I've been here, and also Ashley, who I worked with on this story, was on the police beat for 7 years before we did this story. And the two of us have worked together a lot. And so we had the institutional knowledge and the context, and even remembered some of these players from our past reporting. And it was really funny because in some of the cases, I had done the story years ago about a certain police officer, and Ashley was the one who remembered it rather than me. So we really have this kind of mind meld going on. And we've talked many times about how our history here in Milwaukee and everything that we've been reporting on throughout our time here really was what made it possible to create this project and bring this story together, because so much of it involved stories we had covered in the past, and someone brand new coming in just wouldn't have that background or that knowledge of all these complex relationships.
Let's look at another figure in this piece. That is Stephen DeVogas, and he was chair of the city's police oversight board, recently stepping down the Fire and Police Commission. Where does he factor in with the questioning of Haywood Sr. in August of 2019?
And this question is really the crux of the matter. So Stephen DeVogas was Kalen Haywood Sr.'s real estate attorney. So he worked for Haywood's company. Their offices were in the same building, and they're also good friends. Now, as the chair of the Fire and Police Commission in Milwaukee, DeVogas was among the people who had the final say on discipline and promotions for police officers, including that detective who questioned Haywood. And DeVogas also was able to have a say in who would become police chief and whether Alfonso Morales, who was chief at the time, would have his contract renewed. And so when the detective called Haywood Sr. and asked him to come in to be questioned, he showed up with Stephen DeVogas. And the detective later said it made him nervous as hell. It was like he was interviewing his boss's boss's boss, you know, when he was talking to DeVogas. And DeVogas later said that he didn't know what the questioning was going to be about. He only showed up as a real estate lawyer because it might be something that could involve the business. But again, in our reporting and in watching that video and transcribing it, he interrupted 22 different times, and none of those interruptions was about real estate. So it doesn't seem true that he was only there as a real estate lawyer. And as you can imagine, that was highly controversial and seen as a huge conflict of interest.
DeVogas is also under investigation by the city's ethics board. What has that ethics board found?
The ethics board investigation took almost a year to even get off the ground. And the whole time it was pending, people were saying DeVogas should resign. Even Mayor Barrett, who appointed him, was saying DeVogas should resign from the Fire and Police Commission, and he wouldn't do it. Finally, once the ethics board put out subpoenas for DeVogas's tax returns, he resigned. So he dodged the service of the subpoena, so he didn't have to turn over his tax returns, which would show that he was, in fact, being paid by Haywood when this occurred. We're assuming that's what it would show. And then he finally resigned. So with his resignation, the ethics investigation ended because they no longer have jurisdiction over it if he's not a city appointee anymore.
We're talking with investigative journalist Gina Barton about her series on how a sexual assault investigation was handled in Milwaukee and what the Jane Doe case means for power structures and for victim rights. Do you work on sensitive cases involving sexual assault? How do you protect the rights of crime victims? What is the duty of police and prosecutors in these cases? 800-642-1234. Back in a minute with Gina Barton here on the Ideas Network. You're with us for the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We're discussing a sexual assault investigation in Milwaukee, what went wrong, and power structures that exposed failures in victim rights. This is a sensitive conversation, so please take care. It was an anonymous tip to the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel leaked internal police documents about a Jane Doe who reported being sexually assaulted by a prominent real estate developer. Doe came forward in 2019. This case set off an extensive news investigation, raising questions of power structures, about potential political maneuvering. How do you feel about Milwaukee police questioning a suspect at a shelter for victims? Was this a breach of trust? What steps do you think leaders should take to address conflicts of interest? 800-642-1234. We have USA Today journalist Gina Barton, who's with us for 10 more minutes. Gina, when DeVogas resigns, he writes this letter, his resignation letter, and one piece of it, he says, "I've watched this system try to keep people of color in their place as long as I've lived here through public lynchings and sensationalism." What did you make of his resignation letter?
I think during his resignation and previously when DeVogas had news conferences talking about racism that he's experienced in Milwaukee, I think he opened the door to have a larger conversation that people in Milwaukee have needed to have for a long time and have tried to have, but it hasn't really been effective. And the issue is that, yes, people of color are discriminated against and there are huge problems with racism in Milwaukee. But that shouldn't excuse DeVogas' behavior. Both things can be true, that he did something that posed a conflict of interest and he had been a target of racism.
How do you see race surface in the claim of the sexual assault, in the Jane Doe, racial biases and stereotypes about how people should act after an assault?
Some of the research we found showed that Black women were less likely to be believed when they reported sexual assault than white women. And that is very troubling to me and should be, I think, troubling to everyone. The other thing that was really interesting in this case is that Jane Doe was Black and Kaylin Haywood was Black and Stephen DeVogas is Black and the detective who interviewed Jane Doe is Black. And so even though white people were not necessarily involved at the fundamental levels of this case, it was still the power structure led by the white people in Milwaukee that contributed to it going so wrong.
An attorney for the woman you talked with reported that her client had been, quote, repeatedly re-traumatized and disempowered by this process. How were her rights violated?
There were a couple of problems with the police not communicating with Jane Doe. One of the huge ones was that when the partial police report and the video of Haywood's interrogation were leaked to us at the Journal Sentinel, nobody told Jane Doe. And so when I left voice messages for her to try to tell her we were going to be working on the story, that was the first she knew about her case becoming public. And understandably, that was hugely traumatic for her.
Why aren't you identifying the woman by name?
Her name has never been publicly put out there. And as a rule at the Journal Sentinel, we don't use the names of people who have reported sexual assaults to the police just to protect their privacy and to, again, to try not to traumatize them any further than they already have been.
We're talking with Gina Barton, investigative reporter, examining how Milwaukee authorities responded to a reported rape involving a well-connected developer. You can join in with your thoughts on the ramifications here, on ethics, conflicts of interest, how you see Milwaukee today and its power structures. 800-642-1234. Gina, Jane Doe sued the police department and the city. What has happened as a result of that lawsuit?
And this is kind of the hopeful part of this whole series, is that throughout this whole thing, the only person who has been able to achieve meaningful change here is Jane Doe. And so through her lawsuit, she was able to get her case transferred out of the Milwaukee Police Department to the State Department of Justice. And there, hopefully, she will be working with investigators who she can trust that won't be affected by these various conflicts of interest in Milwaukee. That's one thing. The other thing is that as part of the settlement agreement, the police department apologized to her about how her case was handled and has instituted new training for the entire department and more specific training for the detectives and police officers who investigate sensitive crimes such as sexual assault. So she was able to accomplish a lot by taking her power back and filing that lawsuit.
So there are some changes here for victims' rights. How will the city track that these things are done by police, the police department, and that this won't happen again?
The police department did sign a legal settlement promising to do that. So they can be taken back to court if they don't. And the other thing that the settlement did is a victim in Wisconsin has never filed this sort of lawsuit before that allows her to make sure that she's notified, make sure that her rights are respected. So in the past, we had all these victims' rights laws here, but if they weren't enforced, there was really nothing anyone could do about it. And now they know that they can file a lawsuit and get things changed.
Gina, as you look at Milwaukee and at criminal justice and the system in Milwaukee, especially for victims, how should people who are not connected to this story feel about the city?
I think it's very clear that there are some problems with the power structure and the leadership structure in Milwaukee and in the police department. I think that being sexually assaulted is obviously going to be a traumatic and terrible experience, and the thought that the police would make that worse, I think, would make it less likely for victims in the future to come forward. So I really hope that people will reach out to their aldermen, and, you know, when new members of the Fire and Police Commission are being chosen, for example, will make their voices heard about what changes they want.
Gina, thank you for joining us.
You're so welcome.
Gina Barton is an investigative reporter for USA Today, formerly with the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. She co-authored a four-part investigation called Abuse of Trust. We have a link to the series at WPR.org/mornings. Ahead this hour, we look at school districts around the state grappling with widespread pandemic learning loss. How do you feel about starting the year earlier? Would you send your child to summer school to catch up? 800-642-1234. Let's talk about it. News update is next on the Ideas Network. You're with us for the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Just a heads up on our programming here. President Biden will deliver what the White House calls his first primetime address tonight. We will bring you live NPR coverage starting at 7. The address marks 1 year since COVID-19 was declared a pandemic by the World Health Organization. So join us tonight at 7 on Wisconsin Public Radio and at WPR.org. Now, for some Wisconsinites, the pandemic has led to unexpected financial gains. They work from home, they collect the same paycheck, but they're not spending money like they used to. For others, it's meant severe financial hardship. WPR's Rachel Vasquez reports on the workers who are facing the deepest toll from the downturn.
On a cold January day in Green Bay, Rita Love is looking for a new job.
Like this one here is in Florida. And it's a delivery driver for Amazon, flexible, $18 to $25 an hour.
She's not finding anything in Green Bay, so she says she might relocate. Among the endless listings, she spots a housing intake job that she has experience with.
Wow, and I didn't even see this one. Let me look at this. I hadn't got to this one yet. This is one that's new that's been sent out. So
Love says she lost her job at a keg repair plant in March and has been out of work for almost a full year. Unemployment helped for a little bit, but she went without the extra money for 2 full months until state officials launched new extended benefits last week. Love said she'd already been cutting back for months.
Well, what I did was not charging anything, even if I needed it. It has to be a real necessity. And far as my cable was concerned, hey, I can cut that off too, but I need my internet.
She's seen the balances in her bank account drop, and now Love is borrowing money from family to get by.
My brother sends me a couple $100. My daughter, who works overtime, just so she can help me out.
So how many people in Wisconsin are struggling like Love during the pandemic? The Marquette Law School poll has been asking people about this since 2016.
Would you describe your family as living comfortably, just getting by, or struggling to make ends meet?
That's John Johnson with Marquette. He says when the pandemic started, the data they were getting back on that question confused them.
At a top line level, the numbers have been remarkably stable over this year. And in fact, in our most recent poll that we just released, we had the highest number of people saying they're living comfortably since we started asking the question in March of 2016.
That was a full 67% of respondents who said they were living comfortably in late October, despite an economic downturn that's brought historic levels of job loss and business closures. So why does it look like people are doing better than they were before the pandemic? Experts say it's because of the way the recession has mainly impacted certain kinds of workers.
So people in the state have been having this extremely divergent experience based on if you're someone who is in a precarious position, a vulnerable job, or someone who is able to keep working from home, and maybe the largest financial hit you took was simply stopping spending so much money at restaurants or going on vacations.
Marquette's own data confirms that if you look a little closer. Over the pandemic, the number of Black Wisconsinites who said they were struggling rose by 11%, and the number of Hispanic Wisconsinites who said they were just getting by jumped by 12%. The number of white Wisconsinites who said they were living comfortably didn't change at all, at 65%. UW-Madison economist Laura Dresser says that's because black and brown workers are concentrated in low-wage jobs in Wisconsin. And unlike past recessions, the pandemic downturn has hit those workers hard and left higher earners relatively unaffected.
Those of us who are carefully ensconced in our homes are not able to see the desperation in the communities of people who have lost work and cannot figure out how to get food on the table. And so this pandemic exacerbates that divide while giving us fewer ways of seeing across it.
Rita Love is still looking for a new job and trying to stay optimistic. She knows the family that she's leaning on doesn't have a lot of extra money to help out, and she really wants to get back to work.
As long as I'm making a living, an honest living. And that's what makes a person feel good about themselves.
So she clicks through jobs and works on applications 2 hours or more every single day, all in the hopes of getting the kind of steady, full-time job she used to have before the pandemic. Rachel Vasquez, Wisconsin Public Radio.
And now we're discussing learning loss a year into the pandemic. The Hechinger Report covers inequality in education. It found data point to widespread learning loss and dramatic drops in reading achievement in early elementary grades. Think those first and second graders, with students of color faring far worse. Does your child need more schooling to catch up from learning they missed due to the pandemic or in the virtual setting? Would you enroll them in summer school or support an early fall start? 800-642-1234. John Bales is Executive Director of the Wisconsin Association of School District Administrators. John, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Well, let's start with an early start. Governor Evers recently suggested schools could start earlier than normal in the fall. What does that mean? What would that look like?
Well, I think it would vary in each community, depending on the circumstances, the interests and needs. But generally speaking, it would simply mean we wouldn't be looking for a post-Labor Day start, and we'd be able to get students back engaged with school at an earlier date. It would probably vary by district in terms of the actual start time, again, based on their interests and needs in their population.
Is this something that is currently being discussed? Is it on the table with districts?
Oh, yes. Very common conversation in districts, both for early start, adjusting calendars throughout the year, next year, and certainly the summer school idea of getting kids reengaged. Very common discussion. I expect we'll see a good deal of that around the state.
We'll talk about summer school here in just a moment, but what would schools need to do to move their start date?
It's a process of requesting a waiver for the start time. That would be through the Department of Instruction. There is a statutory allowance for that for them under emergency circumstances, and certainly the pandemic would qualify as an emergency if ever there was one.
Are schools already doing this? Have there been those waivers in the works?
Yes, there are some that have already been submitted. There are a lot of plans going on right now, accessing and surveying parents in the community in terms of their interest level, sort of your opening questions about what's the interest, would they send their children, what sorts of programming and concerns do they have that they'd like to see addressed. So I think you'll see a lot of variety in the programs, but that planning is going on in earnest right now.
Generally speaking, you know, how early is early? Are we, you know, it's not after Labor Day, but are we talking, you know, August, July, June? I mean, what do these districts mean by an early start?
Well, I think, Kate, that'll vary a little bit as well. But I think most districts are looking at some start time in August, and that would be in combination with summer school likely. And that also varies in terms of start and ending points for summer school throughout the summer. Again, they'd probably look at their local circumstances of parent interest, the extent to which families, for example, are in need of getting back into the workforce. They might have been laid off or at home during this time, but they're going to be going back to the workforce now. And what can schools do to support and accommodate that?
What have you seen by way of parent surveys? How are they gathering input from parents?
That's a really good question. Well, most districts are pretty adept at surveying parents, often putting out things.
Don't I know that? Okay, carry on.
There you go.
Save just a few.
I think, you have to remember they're public schools, and so they are responsive and should be to public interest, public needs. So there's a lot of the surveying going on. That's relatively easy to do. Somewhat more difficult if you have a lot of parents who don't have access to internet and quick and easy electronic ways to do it. So mm-hmm. then you still have to mailing and other sources. But at any rate, they're doing that. And actually, to your question, it varies again by community. If a district was fortunate enough to have the circumstances where they could be open much of the year, you'll hear from some of those parents that we'd like the kids to have a break and that they'd like to have summer, where they don't have an obligation to be in summer school, or they'd like the full summer and they don't want to come back early. If the early start is also coupled with the possibility of adjusting calendars, then you always have family situations where they're either more or less able to accommodate a calendar start. So you'll see differences. If districts were largely virtual due to their community circumstances of not being able to get kids into the building easily and safely, then they're more likely to be pressing for both summer school and early start for kids.
We're talking with John Bales, who's executive director of the Wisconsin Association of School District Administrators, and we're examining how districts are addressing learning loss in the pandemic and what those discussions might look like. John, how do teachers feel about the potential early start? Is there any insights there?
Well, like the community, districts will be surveying staff as well in terms of their interest and their ability to do that. It may result, if you don't have access to a full staffing, it might mean adjusting programming for the opening of school early. But I think generally speaking, there's a keen interest on the educators' part to get re-engaged with kids, especially in those cases where they've had to be virtual for a good length of time. They're very anxious to get re-engaged with the students, particularly in the, while it's true of all students, I think particularly at the early elementary ages. I think in your opening comments, you referred to the studies suggesting that it's going to be a critical issue for us to make sure that we've got kids reacclimated and that we're...
Yeah, those first and second graders with reading loss and reading achievement has been seriously impacted. That was what the data was indicating. Yep. What concerns do districts have there for that early elementary level?
Well, I think it will vary amongst the students. It has some relationship to the extent to which they were consistently able to engage if they were in virtual learning. Mm-hmm. Not everyone has consistent access. The extent to which there's enrichment opportunities within the family during the time that they might have been removed from school. So it will vary, but I think we know the critical importance of a good foundation for reading and those early literacy opportunities for students. So that'll be a focus area for districts, I'm sure, early on to assess, practically where the kids are at and where do we start.
What would this mean for teacher contracts and how you rework those contracts if your school year changes significantly?
Good question. It would, again, probably vary by district. You might have people that adjust their calendars and simply move the number of days that a teacher might work in their contract. Others might be looking at actually adding days to the year. We're fortunate in that the federal relief packages that have been provided by the federal government will allow us to, in some cases, increase staffing and be able to employ people for those extra days. So I think you'll see a variety of things probably across the state.
John Bales, he heads up the Wisconsin Association of School District Administrators. We're discussing how districts aim to shore up learning loss in the pandemic. Are you worried about your child falling further and further behind? What has been the greatest challenge for them in this pandemic? Parents, what do you think administrators need to know about learning loss? Still time to talk, 800-642-1234. Back in a minute with John Bales here on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. Let's get back to our conversation on what districts may do about learning loss. Governor Evers said at a WISP Politics event last week that schools have an obligation to get kids caught up.
Whether that's summer school or making sure that next year we start, you know, maybe even start early. We have to look at all options, and I know school districts are already considering some of those ideas.
What option is your district discussing with you? Teachers, are you worried that more and more of your kids are falling behind and need intervention this summer? What is your solution? 800-642-1234. John Bales leads the Wisconsin Association of School District Administrators, and he's with us for 10 more minutes. You know, John, our state had a huge achievement gap between white students and students of color before the pandemic struck. And the data tell us these racial and socioeconomic gaps are only growing worse. How are districts addressing this issue?
I think in a variety of ways, Kate, certainly increasing the instructional time around reading and literacy related activities during the day, whether that's been virtual or in person. Adjusting really, in many cases, our instructional methods. We know a great deal more about reading. Your listeners have probably heard and seen information about the science of reading and reevaluating how we go about instructing reading for students. So that professional development and implementation work is ongoing in districts. We have an emphasis on trying to get more reading specialists, reading interventionists in schools. It's going to take a good deal to lift in some cases some of the students, but I think we're also observing that the loss is not as significant as some might have feared for many students. I think it's more appropriate to call it a learning disruption, certainly, but not necessarily a loss. But absolutely for some students it is, and they'll be looking at both methodology shifts as well as increased instructional time with those students and extra time, hence the conversations about summer school, early start, probably after school kinds of programming for enrichment and acceleration. So a good number of opportunities for kids.
What is on the table then with summer school? What options are districts looking at with their summer school programs?
Good question. Again, a lot of variability we see in the planning at this point. Some will run a longer summer school period, so as much as 4 or 5 weeks. Notably, those also include typically, particularly in high-density districts where there's a good deal of poverty amongst the population, they'll be looking at food programs for those students as well, both breakfast and lunch. So it's not just the academic side of the equation. Others will probably still run a more traditional 2 to 3 week session. They might run a couple of those sessions, again, based on parent engagement and how many of them are interested and willing and whether or not they were able to be in person during the year.
When do districts assess eligibility for summer school and what numbers they might have?
Typically, they'll, again, be surveying internally, they may identify students that they would really encourage to participate in some extended learning. And honestly, summer school programming varies greatly, always has, and probably will again in terms of what's included in it. Mm. But typically, they'll look internally as well as then reaching out to parents to see an interest, not only in coming, but what they might be interested in seeing as a part of the program.
We're talking with John Bales, Executive Director of the Wisconsin Association of School District Administrators, and we're looking at what is on the table as districts address learning disruption, as John says, and some learning loss in the pandemic. Bill is with us from Milwaukee. Hi, Bill. What are your thoughts?
Good morning. I worked for 25 years in three different districts in Southeast Wisconsin, and I taught English and writing, and I think summer school is the way to go. The kids want to go to summer school, but they want to go in the mornings. I would go back to modular scheduling, which means two-hour classes. I would start with writing, not reading. Writing is so passive. The kids need to get back into the routine of school first. Don't start hammering them. Let them get back in. And from writing in their journals, I would be able to discover how to proceed. They need to write. Writing leads to reading. Reading does not lead to writing. Summer school is the way to go.
Bill, thank you. John, your insights there that, you know, writing is the way to go here in summer school.
Well, I think Bill makes a good point, and those are the various sorts of conversations going on in the districts in terms of how we spend the time if we engage kids in summer school. You don't want the entire time based on one particular skill. And there's certainly discussion about which skills are most critical to begin with. I think all of the programs will begin by some sort of an assessment of where the kids are in terms of when they present themselves in summer school.
How do you negotiate that delicate balance of summer and, you know, ensuring kids aren't overloaded, that they're not burned out?
Good question, Kate. That is, you know, I think educators very sensitive to that issue. They're not naive to the fact that it's summer for kids and that the year has been intense and traumatic, not just for adults, but for the children as well. And so I think there's going to be a heavy emphasis in combining both learning opportunities and experiences for kids with the socialization, the emotional rebuilding for kids, trying to help them adjust to what they've been through. So I think they'll be looking at ways to balance very much the time that they're spending with them and get them reacclimated, as it were, to the school setting. But kids miss the socialization just as all of us as adults have, and that'll be an important part of getting them into summer school as well.
Have there been talks of what summer school would be like if it has to be virtual, or is virtual summer school off the board?
I wouldn't say it's off the board. Again, it depends on what we're finding now in terms of interest. Frankly, a lot of kids thrive in a virtual environment. And so we may find that districts are designing both and giving parents options for how they might be engaged. In those situations where kids have been largely virtual for a good chunk of the year, I think in those cases, they'll probably be leaning more towards getting them in person so they can get them reacclimated. But frankly, we find a number of parents would like to continue the virtual. In fact, surveying suggests many of them will be interested in that going into the fall as well. So school will probably look different in terms of options that parents might have.
Cindy is with us in Appleton. Hi, Cindy.
Hello. We talked about summer being kind of a burnout area for kids and not them not wanting to go, but there's lots of states where they have year-round school. The kids go to school in the summer, so I think we're making a bigger deal out of that than it is, and I also think parents work in the summer, too, so I just don't think summer school is that big of an issue.
Cindy, thanks. You know, is this a step toward year-round school?
Well, I do think, honestly, in the future, school programming and school calendars will look a little bit different, probably more flexible. Again, you're trying to accommodate, to your last caller's point, the varying interests and wishes of families. And so there are some who highly value longer school opportunities. And there are others who really value the summer. So, you know, it's always districts are in that position of trying to navigate that and satisfy as much as the population while they're still attending to the kids as they can.
John, thank you for joining us.
Thank you. Appreciate the opportunity.
John Bales, Executive Director of the Wisconsin Association of School District Administrators. Stay with us. We check in with a journalist from ProPublica about her reporting in the pandemic. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.